We're going to get started in just a minute. Wonderful. Welcome. I'm Alita Cass, Vice President for Strategic Initiatives and Director of the Freedom of Thought Project, an initiative of the Federalist Society to examine threats to freedoms of thought, speech, and conscience. You can learn more about the project at the Freedom of Thought section on the Federalist Society website. Our theme for this year's conference is corporate rights and individual liberties. What rights do corporations have? Do all corporations have the same rights, regardless of structure or purpose? How should we think about corporations advancing social goals through or outside of the democratic process? And what role or responsibility does the state have when these corporate social goals conflict with the individual liberties of their citizens? Many interesting questions to consider, and we will start at the beginning. What was the founding era thinking about corporations? Did James Madison think corporations were people too? With us to moderate that discussion, we have Judge Jay Richardson. Judge Richardson serves on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, Vanderbilt undergrad, University of Chicago Law School, clerked for Judge Posner and Chief Justice Rehnquist, and also comes, as I understand it, from a family with its own strong history of fighting for freedom and justice. Judge Richardson, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be with us. I
might reframe it instead of just asking what Madison thought and sort of ask what did Americans think about corporate power at the founding, its rights and limits. Living and breathing humans are endowed with their creator with certain rights and granted government protection of those natural rights, along with others that are not so natural. But corporations maybe not. They are created by states and may lack the natural rights possessed by man. Yet corporations are deeply rooted in our constitutional tradition and entitled to at least some constitutional and legal rights. It's simply a legally recognized group of people associating to cooperate in the service of a common end. Yet thinking about these free associations requires a different mindset about ideas and rights and privileges. Even so, the roots of corporate personhood stretch back to our English common law tradition and existed in the minds of the founding generation too. Blackstone's Commentaries of Corporations is included in the chapter on the rights of persons, and Wilson and many others describe the role of corporate personhood. But deep skepticism toward corporations and their potential for abuse existed as well. And we want to talk about both today. I'm excited to hear from our distinguished panelists today as they talk through the founding generation and its understanding of corporations, their worries about its abuse, and the limits that they sought to impose. I'd like to start with my good friend, Professor Mahoney, who's the Battle Professor of Law at UVA, where she's a beloved professor on a variety of topics, including constitutional law, property, and the like. A Yale Law graduate, she worked at Wachtell before joining UVA in 1999, and with a broad and influential range of scholarship, including recent work on state standings and takings and original meaning. And I must add, given the nature of our gathering today, that she is devoted to academic freedom and has worked tirelessly to champion it. Professor, can you start talking with us a little bit about the concerns about the dangers of corporate power at the time of our nation's founding?
Yes, indeed. And thank you very much to the Freedom of Thought Project, and thank you for that wonderful introduction, Judge. In thinking about corporate rights and individual liberties in the early 21st century, it is, I believe, highly illuminating to go back to the beginning of the United States as a nation. And to keep in mind that the founding generation was deeply concerned about, indeed, I would say, obsessed with corruption. And they were obsessed with corruption, in a sense, that highlighted the potential dangers of corporations as a potent vehicle, maybe, at least in some circumstances, for corruption. Now, the term corruption, as used in the founding and early national era, it is crucial, I think, to understand, comprised far more than bribery and other forms of standard quid pro quo corruption. Of course, the founding generation was concerned about bribery and quid pro quo corruption, whereby a public official would accept something of value in return for doing something that she shouldn't do or not doing something that ought to be done. But corruption, as commonly employed by members of the founding generation, referred often to a systemic problem, by which those in power, both executive and legislative, would in effect, or so detractors would say, rig the system by restricting entry into valuable economic activities. These restrictions were frequently imposed by the creation of monopolies, about which the founding generation was extremely suspicious, and by the grant of restrictive corporate charters that bestowed special privileges on a selected few, that were, of course, selected by government actors. Now, to be clear, in no way is it accurate to suggest that in the revolutionary and early national eras, and in the going into the early to mid-19th century, corporations were in some way regarded as inherently toxic or bad, not in the least, as Judge Richardson just said. Very, very, very important components of society. Governments granted corporate charters for many, many different sorts of organizations, including for-profit corporations that were charged with and empowered to construct and maintain crucial infrastructure, think bridges and canals. The Bank of England, created in 1694 in order to facilitate public finance and smooth out the difficulties that governments had and that sovereigns had in terms of borrowing. We also saw a lot of corporate charters granted to nonprofit institutions and flat-out charitable institutions. So the corporate form, with its limitations on liability for investors and other formidable benefits, was a welcome innovation. And not just a welcome innovation, an innovation that was at the heart of the extraordinary surge in economic growth that began in the early 18th century in the West, including in the British colonies that were to make up the new United States of America, and eventually spread throughout the world, leading for us all in the early 21st century to live in a world of extraordinary technological development, prosperity, and security. Not that there aren't problems today, but I think it's very important to always keep in perspective just how extraordinarily far we have come in the last three centuries in the world. But getting back to the founding era, the dangers of what today we call crony capitalism were evident. And these dangers featured prominently in many debates in the early national era, including the ferocious debates about the creation, the expiration, the renewal, and the eventual non-renewal of the Bank of the United States. Originally chartered in 1791 for a term of 20 years, its formation contributed to a deep chasm between Jefferson and Madison on the one hand and Alexander Hamilton on the other, because Jefferson and Madison saw that what Hamilton and other supporters of the Bank of the United States wished to do, from their perspective anyway, was to empower a financial elite which would then possibly work very closely with the government in a way that would help make the United States, or risk the United States being turned into, a kind of limited access society, one where the benefits of liberty were open not to all, or at least not to a lot, but open only to a few favored cronies of the government. Hamilton, of course, vehemently opposed this characterization of the Bank of the United States. This was going to be an innovative financial institution, chartered, of course, by the United States government, that was going to deliver prosperity for all. We can see everyone's perspective on this. The Bank of the United States, the original bank, lapsed in 1811. And in the next 5 years, the United States did indeed run into some significant difficulty in financing its operations, particularly as it had to wage the War of 1812. And in 1816, the the second Bank of the United States was created with a 20-year charter, and by 1832, the controversies over whether we were going to be a limited access society, a more open access society, were again in full swing. And then President Andrew Jackson produced his famous veto message when he vetoed a bill that would have provided for the renewal of the charter of the Bank of the United States. And what Andrew Jackson had to say in his famous veto message resonates with us today. He wrote, "Every monopoly and all exclusive privileges are granted at the expense of the public, which ought to receive a fair equivalent. The many millions which this act proposes to bestow on the stockholders of the existing bank must come directly or indirectly out of the earnings of the American people. The value of the monopoly in this case may be correctly ascertained, and it was, in Jackson's view, massive." So Jackson vetoes the renewal, and he says in this message, he goes on to say that while he does not have the power to put an end to every special privilege that he sees, that we can at least, he says, push back against and prevent, quote, all new grants of monopolies and exclusive privileges, against any prostitution of our government to the advancement of the few at the expense of the many. Now, in the mid-19th century, the idea that there should not be special privileges began to gain enormous momentum. And one way in which we see that idea gaining momentum is in the passage of laws and the amendment of state constitutions to flatly prohibit the granting of corporate charters that would give special privileges. And with that, I will turn things over to Lyle, who will continue the story.
Right. In theory, the story now will pick up with Lyle Weinberger, who's a fellow at the Constitutional Law Center with Professor McConnell out at Stanford. Lyle is a lawyer, historian, and deep thinker. He graduated from the University of Chicago Law School and clerked for Justice Gorsuch, Judge Easterbrook, and Idaho Supreme Court Justice Eisenman. He served as a fellow at Harvard and Stanford while balancing being an associate at Gibson Dunn. For the young lawyers in the room, you should ask him how he manages to do all of that. He's got a PhD in history from Chicago with a focus on American legal history, rare and valued background for originalist thought, and his wide scholarly and public appearances have made him a prominent voice in the ongoing debates. But Lyle, drawing a little bit on Julio's discussion, can you talk a little bit about how the modern corporation compares and how it evolved in the years sort of after Jackson's veto message?
Well, thank you, Judge, for that extremely generous introduction. Thank you to the Freedom of Thought Project and the Federalist Society for hosting this really important conversation. Julia did a wonderful job kicking us off with this deep set of political theory concerns about corruption and concentrations of power. And of course, the founders on this and many other issues often shared political commitments at relatively high levels of abstraction and then disagreed passionately about them when it came time to implement on the ground. A familiar dynamic to many of us in this room, and anybody who's been around Federalist Society conversations for a while, where many of us find ourselves having some shared constitutional commitments and concerns, and then many points for disagreement and hopefully productive debate, which is continuing today, I trust. This is the dynamic that made it possible for Madison and Hamilton to collaborate on constitutional design, on ratification, on authoring the Federalist Papers, and then to passionately disagree about the Bank of the United States and the emerging political economy of the early republic. But then, how to apply the founders' concerns about concentrated power changed too as the nature of the corporate form changed. Corporations of the 1780s were in many ways not the same as corporations of the mid-19th century. And with that change, it becomes harder rather than easier to tell how to apply the founders' concerns about concentrated power that Julia so eloquently described. So for my time in this opening statement, I want to tell a bit of the historical development of the story of corporations from the founding period into the 19th century, and then close with a couple thoughts about how this takes us forward. Let's start by picking up the thread that Julia already introduced about corporations coming as the grace of the sovereign, the special act of the sovereign. Because for quite a long time in English law, the backdrop that all of the American colonies were familiar with, the act of incorporation was a special act of grace by the sovereign, by the king. The early corporations were a delegation by the king to accomplish public purposes. And indeed, at the outset, the default rule was that colonial legislatures were forbidden from granting corporate privileges without royal permission. So you could not incorporate in America in the colonies. Now, there were various workarounds and sort of de facto corporations, interesting conversation, but in general, it was difficult to have access to the corporate form until independence. With independence, the restraints were off, and the right to incorporate was no longer the domain of the crown. Now the American legislatures could, with a great deal of freedom, bestow this privilege of incorporation. Things changed, although from some perspectives, we might think it looks a bit slow at the start. The last 20 years of the 18th century, by one scholar's count, just over 300 corporations acts of incorporation were granted across all of the colonies. And incorporation was still a legal privilege. It was still the domain of the sovereign to be granted by a special act. One could not simply opt into a generally available system of corporate law. So how did Americans learn to love incorporation? I want to suggest that the answer is maybe an unexpected corner of the world, at church. No, not from the pulpit, but in the church trustee meeting, church board meetings. The first beneficiaries of general incorporation statutes were churches. General incorporation was first thought of as a way to democratize the benefits of the corporate form while avoiding the risks of religious establishment involved in special acts of incorporation. Remember that most colonies had established churches in one form or another before independence, and they only began to end these establishments after independence. And the process of disestablishment took a while and varied from one colony to the next. But by 1790, a majority of the states, 11 out of 14, had either abolished religious assessments or they had at least failed to renew their mechanisms for religious assessments. And so formal tax-supported establishments were dying out. And the last of them, though, didn't die out in New England until well into the 19th century, 1833, in Massachusetts. The end of public funding for churches directly correlated with an increase in preachers per capita, more active competition among denominations. You have the incredible profusion of religious organizations and sects in the Second Great Awakening. Historians and sociologists of religion have argued that the process of disestablishment effectively freed up a market for religious competition, and what followed was lots of creativity and some amount of chaos. As churches proliferated, though, it wasn't always easy to sort out matters of simple day-to-day functioning. How do you sort out the legal existence of these organizations as they acquired and disposed of buildings, as they fought over control of assets, as they hired and fired ministers? the solution, turned out, was incorporation. Incorporation provided churches with a way to exercise greater control over succession by giving the church body the ability to appoint trustees, for instance, by establishing how ownership worked. But how to incorporate a church in an era of special incorporation raised complicated questions of politics, religious politics, and there was concern that this would become just establishment by another means and would end up privileging folks on the in with the legislature to the detriment of those who were on the outs. The way to square this circle was general incorporation. New York led the way. It was the first state to disestablish church, 1777. 1784, the first general incorporation statute of any sort in America was for religious bodies, providing a way for them to simply opt in, no special act of legislation needed, and say, we are incorporating under this set of established provisions. And churches quickly became among the most common entities to incorporate in early America. It was churches, and then the other was actually local government entities, townships, municipalities, counties. So very, very much not the standard business corporation that is often what we think of first when we talk about corporate power. Churches led the way. They were not alone. Americans were joiners. And this takes us into the other aspect of early 19th century corporations' development, that civic associations became widespread, very common, and incorporation became very appealing to these as well, for many of the same reasons it was appealing to churches. The members of these corporations are increasing rapidly and daily, a judge wrote in 1810. And over the first three or four decades of the 19th century, massive numbers of associations were formed, and many of them incorporated. We still didn't have general incorporation. That was, in most places, that was a slow process over the course of the 19th century. But legislatures routinely were passing acts of incorporation that were recognizing these associations. And when America's greatest observer, Alexis de Tocqueville, visited the young nation a few decades later, the associational trend was progressed to impressive heights. Tocqueville wrote, Americans of all ages, all conditions, all minds constantly unite. Not only do they have commercial and industrial associations in which all take part, but they have 1,000 other kinds. Religious, moral, grave, feudal, very general and very particular, immense and very small. On he goes. They use it to found seminaries, buildings, raise churches, create hospitals, prisons, schools. On and on it goes. Many of you probably know this passage where he concludes where in France you would find a great project led by the government. In England you would find it led by a great lord. Count on it that you will perceive an association in the United States. That's what Tocqueville observed, and what the courts and legislatures observed was that these associations liked to incorporate. And there are then, over the ensuing years, these institutions actually lead the way in some of the developments, some of the early litigation, providing some of the opportunities for courts to sort out how much will you police the internal affairs of these organizations, how hands-off should you be. The business corporation then was the beneficiary of this broader cultural passion for joining, organizing, and incorporating. One could find plenty of Americans who were distrustful of bankers and of big business, but they too, even the most populist, valued the ability to associate, to organize, and the simple legal tool of incorporation benefited both alike. So to conclude, let me note two possible ways to understand this history, options that I suspect will be in the background of many of our conversations as the day proceeds. One is that maybe we would see in this robust, flourishing world of private voluntary associations a happy story. Maybe general incorporation laws provided the democratic solution to the problems of corruption and cronyism that Julia raised. Maybe these organizations, in a kind of quasi-Madisonian way, will check each other, and in a large republic, they can, by their interaction and occasional conflict, they can help avoid takeover by any single private faction. Or maybe the story is a less happy one. Maybe by spreading the benefits of the corporate form freely to the American people, everyone has the chance to amass power, but then it leaves the potential problem that if in this rough and tumble world of incorporated associations, if the power balances get out of whack, if certain corporations prove to be maybe too effective at amassing wealth and power, how can one put the genie back into the bottle? Could we have created the monster after the end of special incorporation with general availability of incorporation? Do we have fewer resources to check accumulations of power? But could we check it without causing harm to the free development of churches, voluntary associations, the kind of institutions that even the most populist might deeply appreciate? So whose power is most in need of being checked? That is the question that drives many of the major American debates about corporate power at the end of the 19th century as we move towards the era of trust busting. And with that, I'll turn it over to Doha.
Great. So we're very, very pleased to have the Honorable Doha Mekki with us. She's the Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Antitrust Division at the department. She manages hundreds of attorneys that are investigating and prosecuting civil and criminal violations of antitrust and competition laws. She's been at the Antitrust Division since 2015, following private practice, and she has rightfully received an array of awards for playing a pivotal role in the division's priorities, including a particular focus on labor markets. She holds a BA from Duke, a JD from Pennsylvania, University of Pennsylvania, and an MBE in bioethics. Not sure how that relates to where we're going to go today, but maybe she'll bring it around for us, from the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. She's made a habit of being willing to engage in the debates of the day, including at places that aren't always friendly to everything she believes in. And so we are particularly pleased to have her with us today. And Doha, maybe let's start a little bit with where Lyle ended, that maybe there's a less happy version of general incorporation, and that we've ended up perhaps in a world where we need some check on those corporations. Can you talk a little bit about, from a historical perspective, the Supreme Court's concerns that have been long expressed, the need to arrest that concentration, and what areas of reform you think sort of like resonate today?
Certainly. Thank you so much, Judge Richardson, and thank you to the Federalist Society and the Freedom of Thought Project for having me here. It is true, this is perhaps not a natural home for someone like myself who is an appointee in the administration, but I posit this is actually my third administration at the Justice Department, and I've seen a lot of different ways of enforcing the antitrust laws, and I'm so privileged to be able to serve in this moment where antitrust is in the zeitgeist, and it's really uncomfortable for people like me who have never been cool, but it's an opportunity to talk about something that is incredibly important and that I think really goes to the core of economic liberty. So I am not an academic, I'm not a historian, I am a humble practitioner. I am a humble practitioner who grew up in the executive branch, and so it is my full-time job to think about how to apply the law to facts. And I happen to be doing that in this moment where people across an array of views, a political continuum, if you will, are very concerned about corporate power. And that's very exciting because it's a chance to do something that really accrues to the economic liberty of ordinary people. And that is the best and highest calling for a public servant such as myself. So in the standard telling, we have a few antitrust statutes, the Sherman Act being the most famous of them, and the Clayton Act, which was passed in 1914. And deals with a variety of different acts of the corporation. And again, in the standard telling, there's Section 1 of the Sherman Act, which deals with conspiracies and economic cartels. And then there's the cornerstone, Section 2, which deals with monopolization and conspiracies to monopolize and the inchoate offense of attempted monopolization. And then there's the illegal merger, the merger to monopoly, or maybe a merger to duopoly or something like that. And we enforce that law, those laws, and there has been a pendulum swing over the 130 years or so that we have had federal antitrust legislation in this country. But the truth is that antitrust is actually, it goes much deeper than those statutes. There has been opprobrium associated with monopoly for a long time. Some scholars posit that there are provisions of Hammurabi's code that were concerned with monopoly. Aristotle writes about how it is unjust to have, take up corners in olives and presses and then to charge high prices for olive oil in times of great demand. There are provisions of Justinian's code and early Christian thought and Islamic thought about why monopoly is concerning. And so it is not extraordinary then that the founders, and Madison in particular, would have had concern about monopoly. And in fact, in Thomas Jefferson's letters with James Madison, he's off in France, and he's writing to his pal James Madison about this newfangled constitution that they were working on, and he offers some plaudits. But one source of criticism is that the Constitution does not expressly outlaw monopoly. And of course, he was concerned with the government grant of monopoly power. And I should say, I grew up in North Carolina, and so it is right in our Constitution, we're very proud of this, that monopoly, this is a quote, monopoly is antithetical to the genius of a free state. And so again, you see this in state constitutions, in discussions about the federal constitution. And I think that is because antitrust and the earlier anti-monopoly movement, and to be clear, those things are different, right? The antitrust laws were passed to take on a very particular type of the corporate form, which was the trust, right? And the trust were introducing a sort of private coercive power that really intruded on many aspects of life in the late 19th century. And you need only take a spin through Henry Demarest Lloyd's article in 1893 in, I think it's The Atlantic, where he writes about the great monopoly. And it is hard reading, and if you care deeply and passionately about the American people, as I do, it is a vivid illustration of why life is brutal under the Standard Oil monopoly. And he takes great pains to talk about their conspiracies with the railroad and how they've taken up corners and corn and wheat. And there was concern that the rich would never be held to account, and that there was a sort of verticality of that tyranny, that it wasn't enough that they took up corners in the railroads and in petroleum, but that they were able to then use that wealth to amass power in newspapers and other, again, aspects of American life that really accrue to our social, political, and economic liberty. The other thing I would point out is that, antitrust and economic liberty really go hand in hand. Justice Black writes in a famous Supreme Court opinion called Northern Pacific Railroad that the antitrust laws are a comprehensive charter of economic liberty. He writes about how they accrue to our social, political, and democratic institutions, but at its core, the Sherman Act is concerned with competition. And so the economic dispersion of opportunity, again, goes to this idea that if you disperse power, it is liberty enhancing. And I credit my conservative friends and those in the conservative legal movement who I think were fastest in the modern era to recognize that there are ways in which private coercive power of corporations can be as dangerous or harmful to American life as the intrusions of the state. And that is particularly resonant in this moment where there are big debates about whether government intervention in markets is appropriate. How to, you know, there's discussion about error types. Should we be concerned about false positives or should we be more concerned about false negatives? And again, there's this long-held tradition that favors enforcement, vigorous enforcement, early enforcement, right? You see Congress, every time it amends the antitrust laws, it actually gives the government more power, right, to rein in monopoly power, and it also gives the people a private right of action, right? To me, there's a very comprehensive picture about concern with private coercive power. And yet, in the late 1970s, there's sort of a new wave of thinking that starts to take hold. And for the last 40 years or so, we have had a more hands-off approach. We have had less funding for antitrust enforcement. And I think that we are now in this moment where people across the continuum are taking stock of whether that experiment was an appropriate one or whether adjustments are in order. And I think there are a few things that have brought people to that debate. There was the financial crisis and a two-tiered recovery from that financial crisis, and a view among some in this country that in the face of crisis, there were ways in which government took action to redistribute wealth to certain people at the expense of others. There was the massive demand-side market failure that was ushered in by the pandemic. And again, there is an example of a government response. And I think for young people in this country, their lives have been punctuated by these two crises. And so it is not extraordinary then that they have some questions about how markets are working and what markets are supposed to do for ordinary people. And I think on the right, that has been most clearly, or I guess concern about anti-monopoly has been most clearly expressed in terms of the power of big tech, right? If you are forced to use one search engine, if you are forced to use one platform, if you are limited in your availability of news sources so that you can make decisions about your family and how you want to live your life, the power of one entity to deplatform you or only show you a certain viewpoint, again, that is not expressly the goal of the antitrust laws, but consumer choice and the dispersion of opportunity absolutely is in the wheelhouse of antitrust. And I think that sort of brings us to this moment, and it also helps us understand why conversations like this one are very, very important. So I will end there, and I suspect we'll have an opportunity to talk more about antitrust and corporate forms.
Great. Our final panelist, at least in the opening round, is Ryan Newman, who's the general counsel to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, where he provides him legal counsel and guidance. Prior to his current role, he's had quite a few others. He was counselor to the United States Attorney General, Deputy General Counsel for the Department of Defense, Acting Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Policy, and Chief Counsel to Senator Ted Cruz. He is a West Point graduate who served as an armor officer in the Army, including deploying to Iraq during Operation Iraqi Freedom. He graduated with high honors from the University of Texas and clerked for Justice Alito, Judge Leon, and Judge Edmondson. Ryan, Doa talked a little bit about the federal efforts and the need for reinvigoration to address these founding era concerns with corporate power. But at least at the founding, many would have understood the primary source of regulation for corporate power to be the states. Can you talk to us a little bit about why maybe that's not the perspective we always have today?
I sure will. Thanks for the introduction, Judge. It's great to be back among friends up here in Washington. It's pretty hot and swampy down in Tallahassee, so I thought moving north I would get some relief, but as I was walking around yesterday, I was reminded it's pretty swampy up here as well. Like Doa, I'm not a historian, a legal historian either, but you might have heard we've had some tussles with corporations in the state of Florida. And so I have taken a bit of a renewed interest in this subject. Certainly with respect to the power of state legislatures over corporations, based on my sort of quick review of the history here, I want to throw out, and I want to posit a hypothesis here, that at the end of the day, it seems to me that the federal judiciary has precipitated a constitutional revolution of sorts with respect to this subject in two fundamental ways. First, it has extended certain natural rights, in particular the right of free speech, but others as well, to all corporations, irrespective of whether the particular type and nature of the corporation is a genuine association of natural persons capable of possessing and exercising natural rights. Second, it has applied the Dormant Commerce Clause in such a way to deprive the states of their historic authority to dictate the terms under which corporations may exercise their corporate powers and privileges within a particular state's jurisdiction. These innovations deviate, I think, from founding era practices and were largely foisted on the states and the American public generally by the federal judiciary. The result is that large, now global, corporations have grown stronger and more influential and powerful in American life, while American representative institutions have gotten weaker. Let's take, for example, Amazon. I recently came across an article reporting that Amazon has the fifth largest market cap in the world at nearly $2 trillion. It employs 1.5 million people, second only to Walmart among private corporations, and has annual revenues of about $590 billion, also second to Walmart. Only 9 countries' governments have annual revenues greater than Amazon's, at least according to the article I saw. Now, to be sure, Amazon is not a person in the sense that it has a right to vote in elections. It is not counted for purposes of representation. It has no right to representation in any legislature in the Congress. But then again, why would it ever need the right to vote when it has the right to use vast resources to speak and petition the government on virtually any subject it wishes? To a global corporation with hundreds of billions of dollars, those rights are far more valuable than any right to vote. Because with them, Amazon can wield virtually unchecked cultural power and influence over government officials, politicians, countless voters, and the public generally. Amazon spends millions on progressive social causes. It hires armies of lobbyists to press its interests in Washington and state capitals across the country. It even bans books from its platform, like Ryan Anderson's book, When Harry Became Sally, to manipulate public opinion. It arguably engages in anti-competitive conduct, as when Amazon Web Services has refused to host Parler as a competitor to Twitter. If there ever was a threat to democracy, as the media likes to say, then surely Amazon and similar massive global enterprises like it are it. Even though business corporations were, compared to today, relatively rare at the time of the founding, a number of prominent founders expressed concern about them. We've already been discussing some of this. Thomas Jefferson complained about the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations, which dare already to challenge our government to a trial of strength and bid defiance to the laws of our country. James Madison believed that the indefinite accumulation of property was an evil which ought to be guarded against, and that the power of all corporations ought to be limited in this respect. And James Wilson warned that corporations have, in their progress, counteracted the design of their original formation and should be erected with caution and inspected with care. Even though Amazon is not itself a natural person, it is, as Blackstone described it, an artificial person. The U.S. Supreme Court has nevertheless deemed corporations like Amazon to possess the natural right of free speech, among others. But how can an artificial person possess a natural right? Natural rights, after all, are discernible by reason based on the nature of the human person and the state of nature. Amazon is not a human person, and I think it's fair to say that corporations like it don't exist in the hypothetical state of nature. The Supreme Court attempts to square the apparent circle, this apparent circle, by conceiving of corporations as associations of natural persons, such that the corporation can exercise the rights of the persons who comprise it. But in what sense is a corporation like Amazon really an association of persons? Amazon has over 10 billion shares outstanding. Almost half are owned by institutional investors who are themselves artificial persons. 41% are owned by public companies, again, artificial persons, and individual investors, some. 9% are owned by insiders, like Mr. Bezos. Another stat I saw, 63 to 64% of Amazon stocks are actually held just by institutions, and there's 6,200 of them. These shares are constantly changing hands, and most of the shareholders are just passive investors whose only interest in the company is to increase their return. And who actually controls Amazon? Take, for example, the power to spend corporate resources. Amazon is a Delaware corporation, and under Delaware law, the corporation has the power to make donations for the public welfare or for charitable, scientific, or educational purposes. But who decides where these donations go? Well, management does. Most shareholders, maybe perhaps with the exception of Mr. Bezos, don't really have much of a say. Given how little control most shareholders exercise, it simply does not reflect reality, at least for large publicly traded corporations, to say that the corporation is simply exercising the natural rights of its members. In reality, management is using the vast resources of the shareholders to exercise their own rights and prerogatives. And this is why companies like Disney and Budweiser take positions and do things that are so out of step with most of their customers, their shareholders, and the public generally. I'm not suggesting that no corporation, however constituted, can ever possess and exercise on behalf of its members certain natural rights. Whether a corporation can exercise a natural right, I think, depends on the nature of the corporation and the nature of the right that it seeks to invoke. It is perfectly sensible, for instance, for a corporation formed to aggregate the property of its shareholders and to acquire additional property for corporate purposes to invoke property rights. As early as 1809, Chief Justice Marshall in Bank of the United States versus DeVoe seemed to discern that courts would need to explore the substance and nature of a corporation to determine how the Constitution's provisions should apply to it. In determining that a corporation could qualify as a citizen for purposes of diversity jurisdiction by virtue of the persons who make up the corporation, the Chief Justice observed that the technical definition of a corporation does not uniformly circumscribe its capacities, but that courts for legitimate purpose will contemplate it, the corporation, more substantially. He went on to conclude that it was appropriate to look to the character of the individuals who composed the corporation. But the freewheeling extension of certain natural rights, especially First Amendment rights, to corporations without any exploration of the underlying substance, nature, or reality of a given type of corporation. For example, whether it's a business corporation versus a non-profit corporation, or a closely held corporation versus a publicly traded corporation, is a constitutional innovation, I think, that is out of step with the founding era practices and understandings. And the obvious consequence of extending these rights to all corporations of any type is that the power and authority of the people through their elected representatives to regulate and check the power and influence of corporations, especially in the states, is diminished. In addition to conferring unwarranted natural rights on corporations in the way I've been describing, federal judiciary has also precipitated another significant constitutional revolution in the relationship between corporations and the states that has significantly undermined the power and authority of state legislatures over the corporations operating in our jurisdictions. Remember, corporations owe their existence to the states. The power and privileges of a corporation are determined by state law. But obviously, corporations often operate, especially today, more than one state. For much of the early history of our country, the general rule was that a corporation incorporated in one state could operate in another state as a matter of comity, not as a matter of right. And I would like to commend to you all a great article by Professor Sachs, Harvard law professor, on dormant commerce and corporate jurisdiction. Great, it's a great article on this point. As the Supreme Court put it early on, a corporation can have no legal existence out of the boundaries of the sovereignty by which it is created. It exists only in contemplation of law and by force of the law. And where that law ceases to operate and is no longer obligatory, the corporation can have no existence. It must dwell in the place of its creation, and it cannot migrate to another sovereignty except to the extent that that other sovereignty permits it to. But beginning in the late 19th, early 20th century, the court began robustly applying the Dormant Commerce Clause to prevent the states from exercising their historic authority over the power and privileges of foreign corporations operating in their territories. This means that corporations operating under the rules of incorporation and corporate governance of another state can operate relatively freely in, say, my state of Florida, with little meaningful conditions imposed by the Florida legislature. Florida legislature, for instance, cannot dictate the internal rules of corporate governance for foreign corporations operating in the state, generally speaking. In other words, it could no longer say that only corporations incorporated in Florida that satisfy rules for corporate governance in Florida can exercise the powers and privileges of a corporation in Florida. Indeed, the Supreme Court has gone on to say that states have no interest in regulating the internal affairs of corporations. But of course, how a corporation operating in a state is managed, how a corporation is managed, is actually of great interest to the state. This kind of dawned on me recently, and just reflecting on, you know, some of the disagreements that we've had with, say, the Disney Corporation. The Disney Corporation wanted to use its power and influence to repeal a law that governs what is going to be taught in Florida public schools. It has absolutely nothing to do with Disney's business. So how does Disney reach that determination? Well, that's a question of corporate governance. And so to the extent that corporate managers are sitting atop of massive amounts of resources and then using that power to dictate without any meaningful control by the shareholders to dictate policy in our state, well, actually, as it turns out, how a state is constituted, how it is governed, actually matters a great deal then to the state of Florida. It is a remarkable turn of events that the states now have so little control over corporations that, at least in theory, owe their existence to the states. The states, I fear, are being consumed by their own creation. But alas, this is the world I think our federal judiciary has created. Not a lot of votes taken on this. I just hope the courts haven't sacrificed our Republican institutions on the altar of economic efficiency. But I suppose we shall see.
Never have to worry about Ryan laying low in the tall grass, right? but before we turn to Ryan's thoughts, which might end up being the focus of the rest of our time, we've beaten up on corporate associations an awful lot this morning. And Lal, you talked a little bit about Tocqueville's observations around the founding. Can you give us a little bit of his perspective, not just of the prevalence of those associations, but his belief both in the value of them as well as perhaps their necessity in a society like ours?
Yeah, so Tocqueville, as an observer of American society, read that little passage, but this comes from a chapter that probably familiar to many here, where Tocqueville elaborates on the significance of private associations in doing a whole bunch of different functions in American life. And that last sentence that I read, where he said, you compare this to other countries, in France you would expect the government to be doing this, in England a great lord, but in the United States it's a private voluntary association that is doing, and then he has that long list of activities ranging from hospitals to religious organizations to prisons. We could debate that as well. Tocqueville suggests that there is this relationship between associational activity and governmental activity. And in the background of this, we might see a kind of trade-off that's present here, that if one wants some of the things that associations are providing, you can have them through the private associations, or you could have them through government provision. And so one of the trade-offs that we might think about here is in facilitating the easy formation of private voluntary associations, the state, maybe we could view it as opting for smaller role for state functions, larger role for private provision. We could imagine recalibrating in a different way, where it's much more difficult to form private voluntary associations, and that could be effectuated through corporate law and various other means. And the state provides more of the infrastructure that we want. So I think one of the questions that we have to wrestle with as we look at the role of the corporation, our corporation's persons, how easily should they be formed, is that with the with all the risks that come with the corporate form, we're trading them off against other kinds of risks that come from accumulations of power and just bureaucratic expertise in the public sector. And maybe that's easier to control, but maybe not. And that's certainly something that, with the growth of the administrative state over the 20th century, that we also have to wrestle with, that if we shrink one and the other grows, if there's a hydraulic relationship here, what do we get if we recalibrate? And do we really just shift the problem from one place to another, or do we actually solve the problem of accumulated power?
Julia?
Yes, I do. I have something to say in response to this, and I'm very
glad. I can tell.
You brought this up. You can see me shaking.
That's kind of the goal.
We look at the nonprofit sector and so on, and it doesn't look, it grieves me to say, it looks quite different from the world that de Tocqueville described. It is quite different. Because in particular, when we look at the health sector and the higher education sector, what we see is not a group of civic-minded organizations, but we see organizations that very sadly, though nominally nonprofit, are behaving in a way that many call rapacious and unprincipled, and not without good reason. So many of the pathologies that we have touched on, many of the criticisms that are lobbied against big business are now also lobbied against big nonprofit. That only, I think, adds to the list of problems that we're discussing, but I think it is at least flagging. It is at least worth flagging. But pivoting to big business, it seems that someone on this panel has to defend big business, and I will take it upon myself to do so. It was terrible, the trusts that Doha describes, so from that, yes, many, many, many small businessmen suffered terribly, their families suffered terribly, the kinds of economic recessions that were common in the 19th century were utterly devastating, common, of course, into the early to mid-20th century, and yet, the United States was undergoing explosive economic growth after the Civil War that resulted not only in massive increases in wealth, but also big increases in life expectancy and in health span. And turning to the United States in the last 20 years, yeah, we do seem to be suffering a lot when it comes to health and even life expectancy. We've had some dips in life expectancy, and that is extremely worrisome, and I would never want to dismiss those concerns out of hand. But looking at the United States in the last 20 years, we also see economic flourishing and growth that is way outstripping, say, Europe. And one of the reasons, potentially, is these vampire squid big tech companies and others that come in for such criticism. So, is it possible that some of these very, very large companies, we are in effect having to take the bitter with the sweet? How is bigness inherently bad? Is bigness inherently uncontrollable? Or is this just a matter of maybe tweaking our institutions, our existing institutions, in order to deal more effectively with some of the problems that we have just been talking about?
I'd love to respond.
I thought so. This is great. I don't even have to ask questions.
I appreciate so much that Professor Mahoney is the person who's standing in for business. And I will say this. My family was sustained because my dad was able to start a small business after we moved here. And so there's nothing inherently bad about business. Business is great. We are unrepentant capitalists at the Justice Department. The thing that we are opposite is exploitation. And there are not only the sort of basic experiences of the American people that are brought to bear on how we think about the last 40 to 50 years or so, but there's also empirical support for the idea that there's not just sort of macroeconomic flourishing. I think the more focused question is economic flourishing for whom? 70% of industries are more concentrated than they were 50 years ago. The rate of new business formation has cut in half, right? There are empirical studies that suggest that markups have tripled, right? That's the delta between price and cost in something like 40% of industry. Is all of that to be laid at the feet of big businesses? Of course not. But it does suggest that we need to do a better job of policing when it is that companies cross that threshold for making products and services that people love, that people are freely choosing without economic coercion, to the encroachment on that choice and the limit of different opportunities. And so again, if I made claims about antitrust, which is kind of a microeconomic specialty, and tried to tie them to the macroeconomic environment, I think all of you would throw tomatoes at me. And you should, to be clear. But we should also be aware that there have been periods in our history when some have advocated dialing down antitrust enforcement because of geopolitical concerns, to include when there were calls not to break up AT&T's monopoly, which, by the way, was blessed with the hand of the government for a very long time, because we thought we might lose out in our competitive edge relative to the Soviet Union. And so, again, I think antitrust maybe answers for some of the trade-offs and concerns that Lyle appropriately pointed out, and the really elegant concerns that Professor Mahoney pointed out. There are some people who will tell you that antitrust is maybe an alternative to regulation in some cases. I think some regulation may be necessary in some industries, but I'm thinking about the debates in the Senate when there was discussion about how much and to what extent we should regulate the internet. I think it was Orrin Hatch who said timely and effective antitrust enforcement is preferable to the hand of the government regulating these industries. So I think there is balance. I think antitrust is not a panacea for everything, but I do think that it is a mode of inquiry that can really ground our analysis and help us continue to flourish, right? Because I never bet against American ingenuity, right? We are special. right? We are, we invented flight, we invented the car, right? We, the internet is a gift that we have because of investment from the American military, right? I don't believe that big business alone is the answer for innovation and for our future.
Can I follow up with you on that?
Sure.
Sort of to maybe tie a little bit back to Ryan. You talked a little bit about Standard Oil and not only the limits that it was placing or the harms it was bringing to competition, but also its acquisition of newspapers and sort of more indirect negative sort of repercussions that come from it. When you think about antitrust, particularly from a law enforcement and after the fact perspective, is that part of the consideration that ought to be in play, or is it competition all the way down?
So it's a great question. Antitrust is concerned with horizontality, which is when you buy up your competitors, either the ones that exist today or the ones that might come to be in the future. But it's also concerned with non-horizontal forms of competition. There are really incredible examples of companies using their power and facilitating what we've sometimes called the tyranny of the intermediary, right? They use their all-seeing, all-knowing ability to sort of buy up companies or snuff out competition in the field. And sometimes that looks vertical, which is to say in a supply chain, right? And sometimes that looks like adjacent markets and in ways that threaten future technological paradigms or means of distributing products and services. But I think what's so interesting about the Standard Oil example is you have Standard Oil producing something like 2% of all refined petroleum at that time, like at its height, but controlling 98% of the export of petroleum to other places. And it does so by conspiracy with the railroads. And I think Henry Demarest Lloyd's criticism is that that sort of supernatural astronomical wealth is allowing them to sit atop the economy and essentially buy up corners in related industries. And again, I think you see modern examples of that, which is possibly why more Americans are interested in antitrust enforcement.
So Ryan, maybe you've got a friend in Washington, but talk to me a little bit about, you talked a lot about problems, right? And the challenge that these corporations now pose and the limits that the federal judiciary, which is not only
no,
me,
no offense, Judge,
right?
No, yeah, no.
I took it, but it's okay. but the limits that we've placed on state legislatures, can you give us a little bit of insight into a hope or potential
hope?
Solutions? What should states be doing?
I'm not known for my sense of hope, unfortunately. But I do want to say. I don't have anything against corporations. I mean, American Airlines got me here, and I'm very thankful for that. I mean, I paid for it, or, you know, maybe somebody else did. I don't know. But American Airlines got me here. I don't have anything against corporations. And there's no question that the corporate form, and even a widely held corporation that's able to aggregate lots of capital to do big and important things, is not in itself a bad thing. I just don't want to be governed by corporations. Right? I want the people to govern themselves. And I think that's what's being stripped from the public, is their ability through their representative institutions, as imperfect as these representative institutions can be. And you know, we see this all the time. All the problems with legislatures and the difficult, you know, and the issues with but that's the system. Now, that's what we fought for. That's, right, the ability to govern ourselves. That's what I care about. And so what I was trying to focus on are all the ways that roadblocks have been put up in the path of representative institutions to address problems that may be caused by corporations that are itself a problem. The other thing I want to point out, too, is that, you know, not every problem is an economic problem. I mean, part of what has driven this home for me is why is American Airlines taking positions on voting rights in the state of Texas? You know, why are corporations, you know, why did corporations bully Indiana when Indiana passed a religious freedom law? It has nothing to do with their businesses. They're bullying representative institutions on issues that have nothing to do with their business. They're wielding power that is, in that respect, kind of unprecedented. And, you know, all we're really asking for is, hey, go back and be the best widget maker you can be. Do that. Focus on that. Go make money doing that. Don't have a problem with that. But let's let representative institutions work. So I think some of it is just going to have to be, look, so I don't think we're ever getting back to the original understanding and practices of the founding on this subject. I just don't see that happening. But, you know, small things like, you know, Disney makes a First Amendment retaliation claim against the state of Florida for adjusting its power and authority over the special district that it had. Well, I don't think they should be able to make that claim. Or if the state of Florida wanted to pass a law that says, look, any corporation in the state operating in the state of Florida that wants to lobby the legislature must get a shareholder vote on the position before it can lobby a position before the legislature. Can Florida do that? I mean, maybe it's a bad idea, I'm just suggesting it, but I'm concerned that the legal doctrines that exist, where this wouldn't even have been a close question 200 years ago, you know, shouldn't be an impediment to the state's ability to provide some oversight of these massive, very powerful institutions operating within their jurisdictions.
Julia, you've written on corporate governance and the influence of certain groups on messaging. You want to respond to Ryan's idea? Is it a good one?
Yes, I think it's not entirely, particularly thinking about some of the court's reasoning in the recent Mallory decision. I think it's entirely plausible to think that we could move toward a vision of in the individual states being able to regulate certain corporate practices that's roughly along the lines of what Ryan is suggesting. I mean, it would be done step by step. But I think it's entirely plausible and frankly would not require a revolution in constitutional interpretation, but an adjustment and some of the major dormant commerce clause decisions. But sure, I think actually that the foundation is there and we should talk.
Yes.
For what it's worth, I think that the anti-monopoly tradition and its thought leaders have long recognized that with great economic power, there's increased political power, right? And again, I sort of keep coming back to this theme, the tight interconnectedness of corporate power and government power and questions that go to the core of how we want to live our lives. But in response to Ryan's concerns, I was reminded of a case that all of us read in preparation for this panel, and it's the Dartmouth College case. And there's a great line where the majority writes about corporations, but this being does not share in the civil government of the country unless that be the purpose for which it was created. Finally, I'm so intrigued by Ryan's question, why is everything an economic question? I think that there's certainly some times when there are social and political questions that are kind of dressed up as economic questions, but trying to be glass half full and thinking always about ways to bring people into a conversation and be hopeful, because I do think antitrust is always about the future, right? Americans look to antitrust when we're concerned about the future. I think that economic liberty is a happy space for all of us. I think about, you know, yesterday was Juneteenth, we're gonna celebrate our independence on July 4th. I mean, this is the moment, right, to be thinking about actual and like guaranteed liberty. And, you know, as we think about what citizenship means in this country, we should be mindful that Congress attempted in 1866 to define citizenship, not just in terms of the rights of your political rights or civil rights, sort of traditionally understood, but in terms of real economic rights, right? It wrote in language about your ability to hold property and dispose of it and, essentially lots of rights that I think we now understand as economic rights. And even when we've had our darkest days in this country, right, when different groups have struggled for real and meaningful freedom, I think many people have observed that you can't really have social or political rights and expect to participate fully and meaningfully in our representative republic unless they're backstopped by economic rights and economic liberty. And so again, I'm an antitrust lawyer. I see the world through antitrust. That's my shortcoming for sure. But I think this is a happy place to be, economic liberty. And I think that where there are other tools to swat down overreach of private coercive of powers, we should call that out. But preserve economic liberty is the happy place for ourselves.
So as we could keep talking, but I've been instructed that we're supposed to take questions from you two. Questions, stand up. If you don't mind going to the microphone so folks can hear you.
I have a question, I think, for Lyle on the religious corporations. So, which... To begin, I think that disestablishment was on balance a mistake, which I can say it, I'd suck. But the connection of the corporate form with churches, I think, is a really interesting one. Because as I understand the history, the use of the corporate form for economic enterprise is really quite new, and that back to the Roman Republic, the corporate form was almost exclusively used for religious institutions, churches, monastic orders, etc. And the particular legal features that comprise the corporate form, like limited liability, perpetual existence, have been considered a kind of sacred right that's appropriate for these kinds of religious institutions, but don't fit as well to say more secular things like economic enterprise. And so my question is, when the states in the early republic began to extend general incorporation to religious corporations, was there no trepidation then that we would start extending those to more mundane business enterprises once those started to be extended as well?
Yeah, so the extension of incorporation and kind of who's in and the movement of incorporation from institutions with what you might call a public purpose or a charitable purpose, and these are what Blackstone mostly talks about. It is a really significant move. I mean, so Blackstone's discussion of corporations in English law, he basically has categories of you're either a corporation for public benefit, and there may be a profit motive, think East India Company, or you're a charitable institution. And if you're in that category, I mean, there's also kind of a public benefit component. And then the shift in the early 19th century towards increasingly having corporations that have primarily profit motives, it's a significant shift. And I think one of the threads that might actually be interesting to pull on here is how this connects to the Dartmouth College case, which really reconceptualizes the corporate form from being something that is oriented towards public serving, public focused, civic oriented, towards something that is entirely private and is reconceptualized as a contract that can then be subject to the protections of the Constitution's restraint on modifying contracts. That's a significant twist, and one of the ironies of this is, and it goes to one of Ryan's points, that if we're thinking about this as a problematic about governance, most of the American colonies started as corporations. The charters that they had mm-hmm. were corporate charters. They were granted by the king, letters patent and letters corporate, that allowed them to incorporate. There's a good argument to be had if you want a fun legal historical read. Nico Bui has this great paper, Why Was the Constitution Written Down, or Why the Constitution Was Written Down, where he argues that it is in large part working on the model of a corporate charter, because that's what they all learned from in having their corporate charters written down and granted by the king, and then you become independent, and what do? Well, we're going to write down, it's now not exactly a charter, but it's this new thing, a written constitution. England had an unwritten constitution. So something interesting happened here where we stopped thinking about corporations, though primarily as a mode of governance, in a much more diversified set of governing modalities, where you've got, the East India Company is a government for India. You have governments for the American colonies that are corporate. And then you have governments for the University of Oxford, which is also, so that's charitable and incorporated. So if we undo the Dartmouth College move and we stop thinking about this as an exclusively private arrangement, a whole bunch of options come back on the table. I'm not sure that, whether we should then get rid of perpetual existence and how it works across the board here. Lots more to talk about there, but I think this is the right thread and a very important one to be pulling out.
Thanks. Yes, sir.
Thank you for speaking here today. So this panel started off talking about the issue of corruption from allocating too much power in the hands of corporations. However, Locke, Montesquieu, and even Madison in the Federalist Papers all discussed the issues of allocating the executive, legislative, and judiciary powers in the same person or group of people. So particularly in regard to the administrative state with the FTC, would the founders have ever believed that allocating the executive, legislative, or judiciary powers in the hands of the same people or person would be necessary to combat corporate power in the same way?
So who wants to go off topic and talk about separation of powers?
I'll actually give a quick answer.
Good.
I think no. I mean, I think that would not have been seen as a good solution to counterweight corporate power. Not at all. I mean, on the surface, that can be attractive, the idea that big government, big centralized government, is essential for combating big business. But I think that is wrong. And I do not think that is anything that would have been considered to be in keeping with the original design. Now, I should say, for purposes of full disclosure, I'm a member of the board of advisors of the New Civil Liberties Alliance, which is very active in terms of attempting to right-size the administrative state and very active in terms of making sure that government power is wielded by the entity that it ought to be wielded by. Others.
I think it's fair to say that she speaks for herself, not
yes,
the entire panel.
Exactly, and I speak for myself.
Right. Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm curious. Judge Richardson pointed out that Mr. Newman, many of the problems that you raised are being prevented from being solved by the federal judiciary. And as much as I like the solution that you and Professor Mahoney agreed on, it certainly does not solve all of the issues that you raised. I'm curious, given especially Florida's long history of being an advocate for amending the Constitution using the Article 5 convention process, I'm curious how you would go about structuring an amendment to the Constitution that would solve a lot of the issues that that you have all raised that may be impossible under the current interpretations of the Constitution.
Oh boy, a constitutional amendment. It's tough because I guess part of what I was pointing at was the court's application of the Dormant Commerce Clause, which I think
for the most part, is itself a judicial itself a judicial innovation. So unfortunately, a lot of the constitutional amendments that we would need to enact would be to undo misapplications and interpretations of the Constitution by the federal judiciary. And that's what has created so many of the problems, is the judiciary is just misapplying original understanding of the Constitution for so long in so many areas. So one would be, you know, maybe to take a whack at that, because that certainly seems to be the doctrine that's impairing a lot of the state's ability to regulate, especially large, you know, corporations that do have operations that span across state lines. And that's not to say that there's not something to what the judiciary is doing, obviously, in terms of recognizing, you know, this dormant commerce clause, because the founding generation certainly wanted to have an integrated national economy. There's no question about it. I think my trouble with it is that's why they gave the commerce power to Congress. And so Congress is supposed to decide these things, not the federal judiciary. So I maybe would take a stab at that, and also take a stab at corporate rights, as I was suggesting. The idea that these corporations can wield the First Amendment to influence state policies in areas that really don't have anything to do with the corporation, to me, is a real problem. And it does have real impacts on state legislatures and state, the people's ability to govern themselves, honestly. That's why I try to sort of point out the massive power of a company like Amazon, and why, like, voting to them doesn't make any difference, right? But to the average person, the only power that they have to wield is that vote. And so, my goodness, when they exercise it and they deliver power to their elected representatives, it ought to function, at least at some level.
Great. I think we've got time for one more question.
Oh, great. All right. My question is for our friend from the Justice Department. And thank you very much for being here and helping us hear both sides, although I don't agree with you. You know, when I was listening, when you were talking about the history of antitrust, and you said there was this theory that came up upon us in the 1970s, and I was listening for the words consumer welfare standard, i.e. mergers that make us all richer, and as to who, I'd advise everyone in the room to just look up the work on Walmart as to the extent that they single-handedly have contributed to raising standards of living of people at the very bottom. Now, here's my question for you. One thing about the consumer welfare standard, it is a standard. It is measurable relatively objectively by experts. I did not hear anything from you that could be considered a standard. I did hear some statistics about fewer businesses opening and that sort of thing. So the guy who would have been his own billionaire, you know, under the old standard now has to work for Google. But not any reason to believe that that was better. Aren't you afraid that without a real enunciated standard, that now you're really putting antitrust at the whim of emotionality, you know, populist sentiment, all kinds of winds blowing? That is my concern.
It's a great question, although I think only like 1% of that was actually the question. I will say this, I like my words better. To me, the question is not one that invokes a standard, because there's only one right answer here, which is that to interpret the goal of the antitrust laws, you look to the text of the statute. And Congress was very clear that the goal of the antitrust laws is competition. And so there is a wealth of Supreme Court precedent and interpretation by the courts of appeals in this country that focus on what competition looks like in a particular market and whether that competition has been reduced. That is the question. Frankly, I would be terrified of a world where the executive branch or any member of the executive branch is left to define for themselves what standard we're going to apply when we bring the weight of the federal government to bear on companies and individuals making business decisions in the United States. And so to me, I think that's a side question and a distraction. The question is, what is the law as Congress has written it? And the Supreme Court and the courts of appeals have interpreted it. And I think we are on record over and over and over again saying that is exactly what we are going to do until the end of time.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Julia Doha, Ryan, and Lal. We enjoyed our conversation and look forward to it the rest of the day.
All right. Please join me in thanking our moderator and our panelists for a great conversation. Two quick things for those physically present in the audience who have signed up for CLE. The QR code is on the back of the program. Please make sure you log in with that. We're going to take a 15-minute break and then resume at 10:45 to talk about Citizens United. Thank you so much.